This is the NBC Theater. From the NBC Theater, a full-hour drama based on one of the great novels of American literature, The Portrait of a Lady by Henry James. Henry James wrote with great brilliance and at very great length. His Portrait of a Lady was painted at leisure and in fascinating detail on a canvas that spread over some 900 pages. What we bring you today is not so much a condensation of these 900 pages as a selection of some of the richest incidents and readings of some of the most Jamesian prose. The preparation of The Portrait of a Lady was done for radio by Richard E. Davis. At intermission, we will bring you a recorded commentary on Henry James by the noted critic, journalist, and commentator Henry Outland. Herewith, The Portrait of a Lady by Henry James.
On the carpet of the lawn, extending before a great Tudor country house some 40 miles from London, the flood of summer light had begun to ebb. The air had grown mellow, and the shadows had begun to lengthen across the perfect lawn. In this setting, we begin our simple history as we observe our principal, Miss Isabel Archer, late of Albany, New York, and her guest at tea, a distinguished member of the English nobility, Lord Warburton. It has been said that the English are a cold people, but they are, in fact, the most romantic people in the world. And Lord Warburton was about to give an example of it.
Miss Archer, one's right in the matter of which I'm about to speak is not measured by time. My impression dates from the first hour we met. I fell in love with you then.
I can't believe you're serious.
Oh, I'm a very judicious animal, but when I'm touched, it is for life, Miss Archer. It is for life.
Lord Warburton, how little you know me.
That I don't know you better makes me unhappy enough already.
And if you know me little, I know you even less.
Miss Archer, I'm afraid it's my being an Englishman that makes you hesitate. I know that your uncle thinks you ought to marry in your own country.
Has he told you that?
I spoke perhaps of Americans generally. By the way, if you don't like my home, if you don't care for Lockley, you need never go within 50 miles of it. Some people don't like a moat, you know.
I adore him. I am really and truly not able to regard you in the light of a companion for life.
Smile not at this simple young woman from Albany who rejected an English peer, a gentleman whose holdings were said to be among the largest in England. Smile not, I say, for in spite of the large measure of folly in her wisdom, she was a person of great good faith. When Lord Warburton had left, Isabel Archer returned to the mansion of the estate known as Gardencourt, and there met her cousin Ralph Touchett, whose esteem for her was the highest, and whose knowledge of Warburton's proposal was almost instinctive. His reaction was, as always, sympathetic to both sides.
I feel very sorry for Lord Warburton. He was very much in love with you, Isabel.
But, Ralph, he has seen me only a dozen times.
Lord Warburton is terribly rich. As his wife, you would have been thought a most superior being. Could have done most anything with your life that you wished.
I want to live without the complications of a husband. Why should I begin my life by marrying? There are other things that a woman can do.
But none that she can do so well.
Would you have me marry Lord Warburton?
I'm absolutely without a wish on the subject. But now I shall have the thrill of seeing what a young lady does who won't marry Lord Warburton.
You're teasing me.
No, Isabel. I believe you do want to see life. You'll be hanged if you don't, as the young men say.
I fancy myself too much of a lady to see it as the young men want to see it. But I do want to look about me.
You really want to drain the cup of experience?
I don't want to touch the cup of experience. It's a poison drink from what I hear. I only want to see for myself.
Perhaps that is your error. You want to see, but you don't want to feel.
That is a distinction I must make for myself. I'm sorry I can't give you a better answer to your question.
You've answered my question, Isabel. You've told me what I wanted to know.
It seems to me I've told you very little.
You've told me the great thing, that the world interests you, and that you want to throw yourself into it.
If the truth were to be known, Isabel, although she liked to be thought clever, hated to be thought bookish, and preferred almost any source of information to the printed page. For this reason, our young lady was deeply grateful to certain wealthy individuals in her family who had made possible her visit to England in her 22nd year. Her knowledge was meager, and her ideals were inflated, her confidence at once innocent and dogmatic, her temper at once exacting and indulgent. Her curiosity to see life at first hand was immense, her imagination noble. Considering this, it is not to be wondered that the person at Garden Court who most influenced Isabel was not one of the immediate family, but rather Madame Merle, a visitor and a woman cultivated and civilized, wise and easy. It was said that she had been a welcomed visitor at most of the great homes of the continent, as indeed she was at Garden Court. It was her frequent pleasure to play the piano in the great drawing room and to discuss the pleasures and sorrows of life with her young ward, Isabel Archer.
I've been on this side of the Atlantic since I was a child, Isabel. Now I'm not a good American, and I'm certainly a poor European.
I see nothing at all wrong with living abroad, if that's what agrees with you. I love England. And I'm sure that I'll enjoy the rest of Europe when I see it.
Perhaps. I may have forgotten many of life's pleasant moments. I'm past 40, my dear, and after 40 one can't really feel. The freshness and the quickness have gone.
Are you unhappy, Madame Merle?
Have I the droop of the misunderstood?
No, but you sometimes say things that I think people who have always been happy wouldn't have found out.
I haven't always been happy.
You have lived a full and wonderful life. I'm sure of it.
Full, yes. But now I'm old and stale and faded. That's the difference between us. You're young and fresh, of today. You've the great thing, Isabel. You've actuality.
You make me feel that I must do something with my life. That I must achieve success.
What is your idea of success?
To see the dream of one's youth come true.
This coming to Europe, is that part of your dream?
Yes. And for me, it has come true.
Then take care that it's not shattered. Europe is a poor place for a woman's dreams.
Why do you say that?
One learns from experience. Europe is filled with wealthy American men who represent nothing. Men like your cousin Ralph.
What you say is not fair.
What does he represent with his fortune?
But he's ill. He has consumption.
Fortunately, for him, that's his career. Makes him interesting. Without it, what would he be? Mr. Ralph Touchett, an American who lives in Europe. Very cultivated. He has a very pretty collection of old snuff boxes. With the poor old father, it's different. He represents a great financial house, and that in our day is as good as anything else. For an American, at any rate, that will do very well.
And while Madame Merle played the piano and discoursed on the qualities of the expatriate, the man who was massively identified with a great financial house lay upstairs in the master bedroom of Garden Court and prepared for death. With him was his son Ralph, whose position, again according to Madame Merle, derived from his consumption and his collection of old snuff boxes. The old man, it was plain to see, was close to his end.
Who's that with me? Is it my son?
Yes, it's your son, Daddy.
Ralph, I want to talk a little.
It will tire you.
It doesn't matter if it does. I shall have a long rest. I want to talk about you.
Oh, Let us select a brighter topic.
You were always bright. I used to be proud of your brightness. I should like so much to think you'd do something.
If you leave us, Daddy, I shall do nothing but miss you.
Well, that's just what I don't want. You must get a new interest.
I have more old ones than I know what to do with.
The best thing you can do when I'm gone will be to marry.
First one must have in mind a young lady.
I was thinking of your cousin Isabel.
I am very fond of Isabel,
then
but
why don't you ask her to marry
for you? For a number of reasons, Father. Among them, I don't believe in cousins marrying.
Oh, nonsense, Ralph. We're all each other's cousins on this earth. If we stopped at that, we'd all die out.
Rather than even consider burdening Isabel with an invalid, I should like to do something for her.
What do you mean by that?
I should like to put money in her purse.
Yeah, I thought of that, too. When I die, she will receive a legacy of £5,000.
I should like to leave her a little more.
Hmm?
A character such as Isabel's is a real passionate force. To see it at play is the finest thing in nature. Finer than the finest work of art, than a Greek sculpture, a great painting. Greater than the great arch of a cathedral. I would like to give her a little more.
Yeah, what do you suggest?
Isabel is poor. I would like to make her rich.
Yeah, what do you mean by rich?
Well, I call people rich when they're able to meet the requirements of their imagination. Isabel has a great deal of imagination.
Yeah, so have you, my son.
Take my inheritance, divide it in two. Give Isabel half.
To do with as she likes?
Without any strings attached. Enough money so that she'll never have to marry for a support. Isabel wishes to be free. Your bequest will make her free.
How much do you think that would take?
£70,000. I want to put wind in her sails.
We must be careful not to put too much. Aren't you afraid?
No. Isabel Archer is a most remarkable girl. And I would like to see her sail before the breeze.
I'll see my lawyer tomorrow. Do not let me forget, for I fear I haven't much time left.
Within the week, Isabel's uncle had died. But not before he had seen his lawyer. True to the promise which he had given Ralph, the old gentleman left to Isabel Archer the sum of £70,000. Our young lady from Albany was now a woman of means. She had never expected to possess so much money, and the acquisition of her fortune made a very serious impression upon her, and no less impression upon her worldly friend, Madame Merle.
Isabel, my dear, what do you plan to do with yourself now that you've come... That is to say, now that it's possible for you to do so many things. Will you return to America?
No. No, I thought I would go on to Paris.
Paris? Yes. Yes, that's wise. Paris and then Italy. You would find rich rewards in Italy, and I could serve you well there. I know the most wonderful villa in Florence.
But you are leaving tomorrow, Madame Merle. And there are things here that I must attend to.
I will go first, my dear, and you may follow. Let me make your arrangements.
Oh. You're so wise and kind, Madame Merle.
Then you will come.
Yes. Yes, I will join you at Florence in a fortnight.
Madame Merle left England with curious high hopes, which she carried with her across the Channel to France, across the Alps to Italy, and thence to Florence, where on a sunny afternoon she rented a carriage and drove out to an ancient villa crowning an olive-muffled hill outside the Roman gate of Florence. Madame Merle's destination was the apartment of Gilbert Osmond, a gentleman born in the United States, but long a resident of Italy. His was a somber apartment, set with antiques, whose excellence reflected Mr. Osmond's exquisite taste, but whose small number revealed the gentleman's somewhat limited income. Madame Merle and Mr. Osmond had known each other for many years.
You've bought one or two new things since I was last here.
Yes, yes, by disposing of one of my beloved Correggios.
Why must you all sell your paintings?
Because... course, my dear, as you ought to know, they bring money. And money was needed to pay for my daughter at the convent.
How is dear Pansy?
Delightful, as always.
Did she ask about me?
She mentioned you. Pansy will leave the convent soon and come here to live with me.
How unpleasant for Pansy.
Serena, you do not come here without a purpose these days. What is on your mind?
I was about to tell you that I have a friend whom I wish you to meet.
Oh. And is your friend interesting?
She is Isabel Archer, related to the wealthy Touchett family.
That might make her interesting to you, but not to me. I do not care for empty-headed heiresses, no matter how much money they have.
I know that, Osmond. But I think you will like her. She's as bright as the morning.
Yeah. Well, what do you propose doing with this paragon?
I plan to put the lady in your way.
Well, if she's all you say, she's certainly meant for something better than that.
You're so heartless. It's always been against you. Don't let it ruin this beautiful opportunity for something we both want so much.
My dear, I don't see why an heiress should matter so very much to me when...
When I myself have mattered so little.
Let us not rake up the past, Serena. What is it you want, exactly?
I want you to marry Isabel Archer.
I see. And have you told the young lady about her coming marriage?
What do you take me for, Osmond?
I know what you are, Serena. You are a thoroughly satisfactory woman. Very well. Invite Miss Archer to tea when she arrives. Tell her I invited you and that you would like her to come along.
First, she must fall under the spell of Italy. Then I will bring her to you.
Italy stretched before our young lady as a land of promise. At first, imperfectly seen and felt, it struck her as a land in which a love of the beautiful might be comforted by endless knowledge. For the young lady from Albany to live in such a place as Florence was to hold her young ear all day to a shell of the sea of the past, pausing as if on the edge of a great adventure. When Madame Merle appeared out of the shadows and suggested that they go to tea with a lonely young American who looked like a prince in disguise, our young lady was delighted, and later suspected nothing when Madame Merle excused herself to stroll in the garden while Mr. Osmond showed Isabel his art treasures.
I'm afraid my exhibits are really much overstated by Madame Merle.
Of all these pictures, which one is your favorite, Mr. Osmond?
Well, the little one by the archway. My only remaining Correggio.
Is very lovely.
You know, I found it quite by accident, painted over by a very bad artist. But when I scraped away the surface, I found beneath the pure Correggio, the pure art.
In many ways, that is how Italy is for me. Beneath the surface, so much that is beautiful and serene.
You have a very sensitive nature, Miss Archer. You will enjoy your stay in Italy.
There are times when I think I could stay here forever.
An old Italian saying tells us that a woman's natural mission is where she is most appreciated.
I'm sure you're right. But how can a woman find out where that is?
I wish I could answer you. But so many women waste a lifetime searching for the happiness such as I have found in Florence.
Do you think I might find happiness here?
Miss Archer, I'm sure of it.
As the weeks passed, Isabel gave herself more and more to the company of the quiet, sensitive man on the lonely Tuscan hilltop. And then one day, her old friend reappeared, her cousin, Ralph Touchett. It was a curious meeting, marred by Ralph's comments on Isabel's new associations.
Gilbert Osmond. Mm. Oh, yes, I know him. He's a vague, unexplained American who's been living these 30 years or less in Italy.
Why do you call him unexplained?
Only as a cover for my ignorance. I don't know his antecedents, his family, his origin. He used to live in Rome, but I remember him saying that Rome had grown vulgar.
He has a dread of vulgarity.
That's his special line. Hasn't any other that I know of. He lives on his income, which I suspect of not being vulgarly large. Married young, lost his wife. I believe he has a daughter. But if you were brought there by Madame Merle, you may go de confiance. She knows none but the best people.
It seems to me that you insinuate things about her.
I speak of her as I speak to her, with an even exaggerated respect. Her merits are immense. She's indescribably blameless. Pathless desert of virtue. Only woman I know never gives one a chance.
A chance for what?
I won't answer. Let me only say this. I delight in Madame Merle.
You're very odious, sir.
On the character of everyone else I know, you may find some little black speck. If I were to take half an hour someday, I've no doubt I should be able to find one on you. For my own, of course, I'm spotted like a leopard. But on Madame Merle's, nothing, nothing, nothing.
Well, Gilbert, what do you think now of my find?
Of Isabel? Well, the reception has been very encouraging, Serena.
We must not cry victory too soon.
How it makes one work, this idea of yours.
Don't pretend you don't enjoy it. You're very ungrateful. You've not been so well occupied these many years.
Oh, Serena, what a woman you are. The way you take it is beautiful.
I have no choice. The money is important.
Important to you. But the girl is not disagreeable.
Is that all you can find to say about that fine creature?
Well, isn't it enough? Of how many people have you heard me say more?
You're unfathomable. I'm frightened at the abyss into which I shall have cast her.
Isabel is really a very charming girl. She has only one fault.
What is that?
She has too many ideas.
I warned you she was clever.
Fortunately, these are very bad ideas. I could never live with her unless I believed that her ideas could be changed.
When do you see her again?
This afternoon at the cathedral. She expressed a wish to discuss the stained glass.
That afternoon, as our young lady made her way to the rendezvous, the sky was a blaze of blue, and the splash of the Florentine fountains created in Isabel a repressed ecstasy that was trebled as she entered the great cathedral and found herself beneath the far-reaching dome, washed in the sunlight that drizzled down through the air, silver-thickened by clouds of incense, and mingled with the reflections of medieval marble and gilt and mosaic and bronze. Her conception of happiness in this ancient land rose and dizzily rose, and mingled with the splendid chant of a hidden choir. From the ancient past to Isabel Archer's future was a long stride, but her imagination had taken it in a single flight. And, immersed in the spell, she did not hear the sound of approaching footsteps in time to anticipate the shadow thrown across the line of her vision.
My dear Miss Archer.
Oh, Mr. Osborne. Oh,
I did not mean to frighten you.
I fear I was wrapped in my own thoughts.
The wonderful thoughts of your beautiful mind.
I was thinking of the happiness I have found in Italy, and of how sad I will be when I must go away.
When that day comes, I too shall be sad, for I will miss you.
Do you really think so?
Until you came, I led a quiet life with my paintings, satisfied with my poor lot, until now.
What do you mean?
A great loneliness threatens my life.
You have your daughter.
Since the death of my wife, she has been a great consolation, yes, but the loneliness I speak of comes from my love of you, Isabel.
Osmond.
I'm absolutely in love with you.
Oh, please. Please do not say that.
I've so little to offer you. I've neither fortune nor fame, and I desire neither. My feeling for you is uncomplicated by any other consideration but the fact that, for me, you'll always be the most important woman in the world.
I don't know what to say. I admire you, and I respect you.
Oh, say that you love me, Isabel. Say that you love me. It has made me better loving you. Your love has opened new beauties for me.
Oh, husband, if I were only sure...
Oh, my dearest one, I can't tell what a beautiful life is waiting for us. I simply can't tell you. Like a long summer afternoon that we can share together. The gentle time of the Italian day with a golden haze and that divine delicacy in the light, the air, the landscape, which I have loved all my life and which you love today, Isabel.
Oh, husband, I do love you. I do, I do, I do.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater is bringing you a radio version of The Portrait of a Lady by Henry James. If you are interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these NBC Theater productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement at the close of this program. And now, our intermission commentator, the noted literary critic and commentator, Henry Outland.
Henry James was one of those strangely endowed beings into whose gifts it is curious to drop a plummet now and then. So famed for his originality of plot, characters, and style, he was forever seeking technical hints, indeed suggestions of any kind. Let us see where he got some of them for his Portrait of a Lady. In the early 1870s, when about 30, he settled in Paris. There he heard endless talk on the art of fiction from Flaubert, Turgenev, and their group. Flaubert, until his sentimental education came out, remained James's grand idol. But finding the characters in that novel too thin, James now directed the bulk of his questions to Turgenev. The great Russian master told him this: determine the traits of either a hero or a heroine, just one person. Then fashion other characters solely to throw the relations of that one into relief. James never forgot that. Indeed, he never forgot anything. When, later in the 1870s, he had pumped Turgenev and Paris dry, he headed for London. There, above all else, he would talk, and did, with George Eliot. For years he had been studying her novels passionately, especially Middlemarch. And when her Daniel Deronda appeared, the article he published on it in the Atlantic Monthly shows that Gwendolyn Harleth, Deronda's chief figure, was later to furnish James with hints for Isabel Archer, the heroine of the portrait. James's own cousin, the high-souled and beautiful Mary Temple, was in part the model for Isabel. Many years later, she was also to figure as the angelic Millie Thiel in The Wings of the Dove. In 1881, the portrait ran simultaneously in the Boston Atlantic Monthly and in Macmillan's Magazine in London. With its clear, simple phrases and sparkling dialogue, it is early Henry James of the choicest vintage. In going over it again, I thought it might well be read aloud. And James admitted that he wrote all his works with that intention. Next to The Ambassadors, he considered the portrait showed his finest structural competence.
Thank you, Mr. Outland. Our radio version of The Portrait of a Lady will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
Three years have passed since the marriage of Isabel Archer and Gilbert Osmond, as our history resumes at their house in Rome, the Palazzo Racanera, a dark and massive structure deep in the heart of the Eternal City. To this austere place there came one evening, in the autumn of 1876, a handsome man, whom we met earlier in our history when his proposal of marriage was refused by our young lady. And we discover him now, as he is welcomed by the somewhat eccentric Countess Gemini, sister to Mr. Osmond.
so, you have found your way, Lord Warburton.
The fame of Mrs. Osmond's Thursday evenings has spread even to England.
Never will I understand, Lord Warburton, why Isabel refused you to marry my brother.
I'm sure that she had excellent reasons, Countess.
At the time, perhaps. But marriage can change the mind as well as the heart.
Has she changed?
No woman could remain unchanged, married to my brother. Physically, she bears no marks, no bruises, but her step draws a mass of black drapery behind it. The marriage is a failure.
And yet they continue to live together?
They share the same roof.
What is it that keeps her at his side?
They have a mutual affection for his daughter, Pansy, a delightful girl of 19. Isabel has learned to love the child deeply.
And for the love of his child she stays on?
For this, and because neither will admit that their marriage has failed. There she is now, standing at the balcony.
The years had touched Our Lady only to enrich her. The flower of Isabel's youth had not faded. It hung more quietly on its stem. She had lost some of the quick eagerness of her youth, but her tall, still, supple figure, clad in soft black velvet, as set off in the gilded arch of her palace balcony, made the ideal picture of a gracious lady. Lord Warburton hurried to her side.
Mrs. Osmond.
Lord Warburton, how kind of you to come and see us. You're looking very well.
As always, I find you the most beautiful of women. And well, I hope?
Very.
And happy?
Exceedingly. And you?
Never better. I would that I might say that of another.
What do you mean?
I was on my way to Sicily with your cousin Ralph when he suffered a relapse.
Ralph is here in Rome? Ill?
Very ill. His lungs...
Where can I find him?
The doctors took him from the train to the Hotel de Paris.
Oh, poor Ralph. When can I see him?
Tomorrow. The doctors are with him now.
Has he asked for me?
It is the thought of you that keeps him alive.
Isabel, my dear, don't keep Lord Warburton from
Tell
the dancing.
Tell Ralph I will come to him in the morning.
Come along, Lord Warburton. I've found you a most charming partner for the cotillion.
Oh, I'm afraid I'm rather clumsy, Countess.
Oh, Lord Warburton, no one could help be the soul of grace dancing with Pansy Osmond.
That night, after the guests had gone, as Isabel sat in her room watching the fire, she was disturbed by the entrance of her husband. Tall and gaunt, Osmond sat down and stared in silence at the fire. At last he spoke.
I've come to discuss Lord Warburton.
Really?
According to the Countess Cimini, Lord Warburton showed a lively interest in my daughter. We should encourage such intentions.
Isn't it a little early?
Pansy is a very charming young girl. Lord Warburton may develop certain intentions.
What do you suggest?
This. That with the proper cooperation from you, my daughter has only to sit perfectly quiet to become Lady Warburton.
You want me to lead him on?
Let us say, rather, that you make it easy for him.
What makes you so sure he will fall in love with Pansy?
I'm leaving that, my dear, to you.
You are asking me to persuade him?
A 40-year-old bachelor need not be persuaded of the charms of a fresh young girl of 19. Let him know that no obstacle stands in his way.
What you are proposing is infamous. Assuming that Lord Warburton may be charmed by Pansy's girlish ways, what of her desires?
My daughter, in contrast to my wife, wishes above all to please me. She will do as I like when I point out the advantages of a wealthy marriage.
You should be very familiar with the advantages of a wealthy marriage.
Isabel, I hold that the possibility of realizing the marriage lies in your hands. I leave it there. And now, good night, my dear wife.
Isabel sat before the fire into the small hours of the morning. Osmond was not all to blame, she told herself. There were times when she almost pitied him. For if she had not deceived him in intention during their courtship, she surely deceived him in fact. Under his extraordinary charm, she had not been her true self. She had changed her nature to please Osmond. He had courted one woman and found himself married to another. But he had not changed, and he had not disguised himself during the courtship. She had been so much in love with him then, she had seen only half his nature. And so, suffering from the consequences of mutual self-deception, they had lived in a world of suspicion. Her life had become a solitary journey down a long, dark, narrow alley. What would happen when she reached the dead wall at the end? In the morning, Isabel went to see Ralph at the hotel. Clearly, the end was not too distant.
It is good to see you again, Isabel.
I will come and see you every day if you like.
Please do. I won't be here long.
I thought the doctor said that...
I know what the doctors say. But I'm going home to England, Isabel.
To England? In the winter?
When my time comes, I want to be in England.
Oh, Ralph.
I would rest easier if I could only be sure about you, Isabel.
What do you mean?
I feel so responsible for what has happened to you.
Nothing has happened to me.
When we met in England, it was so long ago. You seemed to be sailing in the bright light over the heads of men. Then suddenly someone tossed up a faded rosebud. A missile that should never have reached you. And straight you dropped to the ground. It hurts me as if I'd fallen myself.
You must not feel that way. What you say is not so, Ralph.
Be honest with a man who's been honest with you. You're the most unhappy of women.
I beseech you, cease. As you love me, as you pity if you must, don't talk of this.
Consider yourself, Isabel.
That is not the solution. We must always be bound by the consideration for others.
Then consider me, Isabel. I love you with the love of one who loves without hope of self. For my sake, then, save yourself before it is too late.
In her heart, Isabel knew that Ralph spoke the truth. How easy it would have been to reject Osmond there and then. But she was resolved that the marriage should not suffer from any action of hers. There was an obligation that had to be fulfilled, and she was determined to be a good wife. And so in the weeks that followed, Isabel turned her attention to carrying out Osmond's wishes and encouraged Lord Warburton in his courtship of Pansy. In this, Isabel felt that she had put off, for the time at least, the disaster that threatened their marriage. Consequently, she was much taken back by a conversation with the Countess Gemini.
You're as busy as Cupid these days, Isabel.
It pleases Gilbert.
I'm sure it does. I wonder if he realizes the true situation with Lord Warburton.
Gilbert finds Lord Warburton's falling in love most agreeable.
Would he be so agreeable if he knew whom it is that Lord Warburton loves?
Pansy, of course. Who else?
Yourself, Isabel. Lord Warburton is in love with you.
That's nonsense.
Of course it's nonsense. But the nonsense is Warburton's.
Has he told you that he's in love with me?
It's plainly seen, Isabel. He speaks well of Pansy, very properly indeed, but it is you he loves.
If you're right, he must not be allowed to marry Pansy.
Would you deliberately thwart Osmond's wishes in this matter?
As a wife, I must act in what I believe to be the best interests of my husband and his daughter. I will speak with Lord Warburton this evening.
You wanted to see me, Isabel?
Come into the drawing room, Lord Warburton. I noticed that you weren't dancing.
No, I was sitting this one out.
And what of Pansy?
Oh, she has more offers than there are dances on the card. And sometimes I think that she finds me a bore. But surely you did not call me here to discuss dancing. What is on your mind?
I want to talk to you about Pansy. How do you feel about her?
She is very charming and very fortunate in finding a stepmother who is so very good to her.
Can you imagine anyone not being?
No, no, indeed. I know how one is charmed with Pansy. It is your influence reflected in her sweet nature.
Ah, yes. If she isn't the rose, she has lived near it.
We all try to live as near it as we can.
Then we must understand each other before a tragedy has begun and another innocent girl is lost.
I beg your pardon.
Is it still your intention to marry my stepdaughter?
It is.
But if she cannot dance with you for an evening, how will she be able to dance with you for life?
Are you suggesting that it would be a bad marriage for her?
Am I? I think Pansy would do wonderful well to marry you. But it strikes me that you're not in love.
But I assure you that I am.
Perhaps you like to think you are while you sit here with me.
Oh, come now. Could anyone be more lovable than Miss Osmond? An excellent reason for any marriage, is it not?
Love has nothing to do with good reason.
I can't agree. I'm delighted to have good reasons.
Of course you are. If you were really in love, you wouldn't care a straw for them.
Really in love? What does that mean? You must remember that I'm past 40 now. I won't pretend I am as I once was.
Nor do I think you feel as you claim about Pansy.
Does this mean that I am to stop seeing her?
I mean merely to clarify the facts. What you do now, Lord Warburton, must be entirely of your own choice.
The weeks passed without any abrupt change in the situation. Ralph returned to England to wait for the end, and Isabel gave him her promise that she would come there if he called for her. Meanwhile, our lady awaited the results of her conversation with Lord Warburton, who had continued his suit, but with what Isabel took to be less the attitude of a man in love than the approach of a sensitive individual bringing ever so gently and subtly to a close an affair which no longer held out hope of success. And it was at this time that Isabel received a visit from her old friend, Madame Merle.
Isabel, my dear, how good it is to find you at home.
Sit down, Madame Merle. You should come more often.
True, but I lack the stamina that I once had.
You are depressed.
Yes, but what is left of my life? Neither husband, nor fortune, nor position, nor the traces of a beauty that I never had.
You have friends.
I'm not so sure. Disappointments sour the best of friendships. Even yours and mine, Isabel.
What do you mean?
Can you not guess how you've disappointed me?
I'm at a loss to understand you.
Then you pretend that you do not know that my heart was set on Pansy's marrying Lord Warburton.
But there was no engagement even.
Exactly. But there could have been with the proper handling.
Your manner is very strange.
I had my heart set on that match.
You and my husband seem to have identical interests.
I know what Osmond thinks. He judges you severely.
When do you discuss me with my husband?
He just left this room after telling me that Lord Warburton is leaving Rome tonight. And not one word has he spoken to Osmond about the wedding. You interfered, didn't you?
You insolent woman. Who are you? What are you? What have you to do with my husband? What have you to do with me?
Since you ask, everything.
That afternoon, Isabel took a drive alone. She wished to be far away under the sky. She had long before this taken old Rome into her confidence, for in a world of ruins, The ruin of her happiness seemed less an unnatural catastrophe. She realized that she had thrown her life away. The part played by Madame Merle was at once clear and distasteful. It was she who had brought Isabel to Italy. It was Madame Merle who had introduced her to Osmond and encouraged her marriage. What motive lay behind this, our lady could not guess. And so at length she returned to the Palazzo Racanera, where she found her husband waiting.
I've been waiting to congratulate you, Isabel.
On what, may I ask?
You've planned a very deep game. You've managed it beautifully.
I have managed nothing.
I accuse you of having prevented Pansy's marriage to Warburton.
I did what I thought best.
Best for yourself.
Oh, Gilbert, for a man who was so fine...
Fine? So... Never was I as fine as you, my dear. But now you've got things the way you wanted. You got him out of the way without appearing to do so, and you've placed me in the position in which you wish to humiliate me. That of a man who has tried to marry his daughter to a lord and grotesquely failed. Come in.
Telegram for the signor.
I'll take it.
That'll be all.
Poor, poor man. My cousin Ralph. He is dying in England.
Oh, Ralph was dying when we married. He'll outlive us all.
Osmond, I must go to England before he dies.
If you do, it'll be against my wishes.
You like nothing I do or don't.
Is that why you must go, then, to take revenge on me?
I know nothing about revenge.
I am very familiar with it, my dear Isabel. Don't give me an occasion.
You've been only too eager for revenge. For 3 years, you've wished immensely that I would commit some folly.
I should be gratified in that case if you disobeyed me.
If I disobeyed you...
I order you to remain in Rome. I forbid you to go to England.
You've no reason for that. And I've every reason for going. I can't tell you how unjust you seem to me. Your attitude is malignant.
I dislike from the bottom of my soul what you intend to do. It's dishonorable, it's indelicate, it's indecent. Your cousin means nothing to me, nothing. My wife does not travel across Europe alone in defiance of my deepest desire to sit at the bedside of another man.
Your mind is vile.
We are indissolubly united. You are nearer to me than any human creature, and I am nearer to you. True, it may be disagreeable proximity, but it's of our own making, and I believe we should accept the consequences of our actions. And what I value most in life is the honor of a thing.
How can even you speak of indissoluble union? Where's our union when you accuse me of playing false? Where's your contentment when you have nothing but hideous suspicion in your heart?
There is honor in living decently together in spite of such drawbacks.
We don't live decently together.
Indeed, we do not live together at all if you go to England. Think it over, my dear wife.
Isabel, what is the matter?
Oh, Countess, my cousin Ralph is dying in England.
I'm very sorry for you.
You would be sorrier still if you knew.
What is there to know? You look poorly. You must have been with Osmond.
I have been with Osmond.
I'm sure then he's been odious. Did he say he was glad poor Mr. Touchett's dying?
He forbade me to go to England.
For what reason?
Because we're so happy together that we can't separate even for a fortnight.
So you've come to appreciate my brother for what he really is. Perhaps this is the time for me to tell you.
Tell me what?
Perhaps you know already. Perhaps you've just guessed. If you have, you have no reason why you shouldn't do as you like.
You're going to tell me something horrible.
You can call it by whatever name you will. My late sister-in-law had no children.
Osmond's first wife had no children?
No. The poor little woman lived for only 3 years after their marriage. And she died childless. Pansy was born after her death.
Pansy is not Osmond's child?
She is his child by another man's wife.
Who was this woman?
Your friend, Madame Merle.
For 7 years, Osmond was her lover, even while she was married before the death of her husband. The birth of the child coincided, fortunately, with the death of her husband and the death of Osmond's wife. Osmond passed the infant off as his own, and Madame Merle renounced her claim in the child.
The poor woman. Poor Madame Merle.
You sympathize with her?
She gave up her child, and I married the man she loved. How could she let me marry him?
It was her idea. You had money.
But why me? There were others with money long before she met me.
Osmond was particular. He would not marry for money alone. She searched all of Europe to find him a wife agreeable to his taste.
Does Osmond still love her?
She's worked for him, plotted for him. She's even more than once found money for him. And the end of it is that he's tired of her. Osmond would not miss Madame Merle if she were removed from the earth.
Does she know this?
She knows it. You need not hate her, Isabel.
I am sorry for her. I'm so terribly sorry for myself.
Isabel, where are you going?
Don't try to stop me, Gilbert.
Get away from that door.
I'm going to Ralph. He needs me.
And what of your husband?
What of my husband, indeed?
I absolutely forbid you to go. You're not yourself.
Why should that matter to you, who never cared?
Do you realize what it means if you leave now?
It means that you will not be expecting me back.
The house in England was somber with the dull air of expectancy that fills a house when death is a momentary guest. Although each day found Ralph weaker and nearer the end, he seemed to be putting death off until he was sure that Isabel had arrived. And then he spoke.
I feel better tonight. I think I can say something.
Don't tire yourself. Dear Ralph.
Been like an angel beside my bed. They talk about the angel of death. It's the most beautiful of all.
This is not death, dear Ralph.
Not for you, no. There's nothing makes us feel so much alive as to see others die. With me, it's all over. I wish it were all over for you.
I would give my life that you might live.
No, Isabel.
Then I would die myself not to lose you.
You won't lose me if you keep me in your heart. I shall be nearer to you than I've ever been. Don't wish for death. Life is better. For in life there is love. Death is good. But there is no love.
I never thanked you. I never spoke. I never was what I should be. And it was your generosity that made my life possible.
I believe I ruined my life.
He would not have married me if I had been poor. I understand that now.
Is it all over then, between you?
Nothing is ever over, really.
Are you going back to Osmond?
Don't ask me, Ralph. I would like just to stay here with you. I feel so very old.
You'll feel young again. I don't believe that such a generous mistake as yours can hurt you for more than a little. Remember this. That if you've been hated, you've also been loved, Isabel. Adored.
Ralph. Now. Now I am alone.
After a while, she stepped from the bed to the window, where the night had ended, and where the light of another day would endure before the dark night came again. The dispassionate passage of time that separates us from the past and leaves us to our own defenses against the future. Where to turn now? America was behind her, an alien land. Only Rome beckoned. Rome, with its immeasurable capacity for sorrow. In Rome, she could drop her sadness into the silence of lonely places that would offer companionship in endurance. Her marriage had been the single sacred act of her life. And even in a union as hideous as her own, there were obligations that were quite independent of the enjoyment extracted from marriage.
You have been listening to The Portrait of a Lady, an NBC Theater production of the novel by Henry James. If you wish to increase your knowledge and appreciation of literature, we suggest that you might enjoy the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC Theater. For full information, write to NBC Theater in care of one of the following universities or colleges: the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky; the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma; Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas; Washington State College, Pullman, Washington; University of Arizona, Tucson, Arizona; Texas College of Arts and Industries, Kingsville, Texas; and Brooklyn College, Brooklyn, New York. Next week, be with us again at the NBC Theater for a dramatization of Edith Wharton's great novel, The House of Mirth, and the following week for Theodore Dreiser's Sister Carrie. The Portrait of a Lady was prepared for broadcast by Richard E. Davis. The narrator was Gain Whitman. Isabel was Michael Ann Barrett. Lord Warburton, Ben Wright. Ralph, Larry Dobkin. Madame Merle, Monty Margetts. Mr. Touchett, Norman Field. Osmond, Tony Barrett. Countess Gemini, Sarah Jane Wells. Your announcer, Don Stanley. Our intermission commentator was Henry Outland, whose commentary was recorded. The director of the NBC Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. Today is Sunday, and one of Broadway's most famous plays will be brought into your living room this evening by Theater Guild on the Air on NBC. It's Elmer Rice's classic story, Counselor at Law, with one of Hollywood's first names, James Cagney, in the leading role. For an exciting performance of a famous stage hit, be sure to hear James Cagney on Theater Guild on the Air this evening on NBC. Your tune for the stars on NBC.